Hello and welcome to Pain in the Dice, because games are fun, but also hard. Sometimes hard, something like that. I'm one of the hosts, Chaz. Joining me is Terry Robinson, other host. And today we're going to talk about Scion Demigod, second edition.
You can keep the demi out of the god, but you can't keep the god out of the... I couldn't come up with any good demigod puns for any of this, which is good because I hate puns. What was the intent of Demigod?
So, Demigod has a couple of really interesting goals that it set out to do, based both on the experience of first edition and what I've heard listening to developer interviews for second edition. Because in Scion first edition, the rules really start to break down once you hit Legend 4. And so Demigod is fully in the broken territory of Legend 5 through 8. And it also doesn't have a kind of unique place. In Scion first edition, there was the arc of the metaplot that played through hero, demigod, and god, and so you had a unique piece of the story. But when you pull back and tell your own story, demigod stories weren't really anything more than hero stories, just with more power. So Demigod 2nd Edition sets out to raise the power cap, and that's kind of just solved through scale. It was one of the core conceits of the system, and then they give you kind of a bunch of extra oomph to your powers, which we'll talk about as we get into the book. But the other thing it did is said, what is the unique story of Demigod, of being a demigod as opposed to being a hero? How do we make that shine in this book? Which we'll also explore. But first, Terry, what is Scion?
Scion is a game of contemporary, epic, mythic, urban fantasy, is the set of adjectives I would say. It posits a world where all extant and several extinct belief sets are in some way true. There is some sort of power to the cosmos, kind of entitled fate, that has the ability to create relationships between people and entities that bend their behavior towards recapitulating or creating certain well-known stories. And that is a remarkably bland way of saying the world wants you to be a mythic hero and to retell the great stories of old. And at some point, you get to start making your own stories. And as you do, those stories change. The world, capital W, as it is called, is psycho-reactive, meaning if you do a great deed associated with a thing out in the world, that item will be associated with you. And it is possible that retroactively, it will always have been associated with you. If Chaz becomes Chaz Invoker of Hearthfires and grows their legend enough, they're commonly discussed as such. History books will be rewritten. Stories will be retold such that the Invoker of Hearthfires was always Chaz. The downside of this is, as your story goes on, you kind of get into a groove, and it is hard to get out of that groove. As you become more heroic, bad things start happening to the people around you, as you are a person of legend, and you must have trials and adversity to prove your mettle. In addition to that, the world posits that just about every polytheistic or non-monotheistic, it's one of those things that you can really start splitting hairs really fast. And I have no formal background in religious studies, so I'm just going to just say that right now. Every extant belief system that has one that has more than one kind of divine being or entity in some way, shape, or form is kicking around, has believers. Those gods very much exist, and people interact with them, whether it be a relationship of bargaining, supplication, or mere storytelling, and they in turn have the ability to affect the world. When that relationship occurs, those two entities kind of get bound to each other, and hilarity ensues. It is also contemporary. You can potentially follow a demigod, hero, or god on Instagram or something similar. There are strange places scattered about the world. Occasionally, the police will have to deal with an outbreak of goblins or something similar. These are all knobs that are adjustable in your game, but that's kind of the setting. Do you have anything to put on top of that, as I probably missed some core conceit?
No, I think that's a good 5,000-foot view of Scion for people joining us for the first time who have not heard us discuss Scion in the past in some format.
The idea is the gods exist all stories are true. New stories can be made. It is hard, and it is hard to get away from stories. I feel like that last part, that legend follows you around and kind of nudges you in its direction, is especially important for Demigod. The opening fiction involves a band encountering Kalizant Zeros, which is some sort of underworld giant thing, because in this game you're constantly beating up ugly underworldish giant things. And there is a brief and infuriating conversation where one of the characters talks about being a Scion, meaning they were either born of, created by, tapped by, or literally are in some way, shape, or form a god, but also adhering to the faith of the people of Judea, so purportedly Jewish. And I'm like, personal beliefs are complicated, but one of the things that I find difficult in the world of Scion is the Abrahamic faiths generally have gotten no representation yet in terms of mechanical support or a notion of those within the core series. And to me, that's a big question. It's not a question of representation, but what does the world look like when you're some of your largest religions don't seemingly have Scions? I don't know. That was a little bit curiosity inducing and infuriating.
The way I would interpret it, and none of this has been kind of explored in the books, but the way I would interpret it is that for religions like Abrahamic faiths who have rules about worship, like there is only one God kind of worship, I would say that in the world of Scion, they interpret it as their god is the only god worthy of worship, and the others are pretenders, not truly divine, not worthy of worship, however you want to suss that out, and then would just hand wave the place in the world. But yeah, it is kind of funny to highlight this Jewish story and never having spoken about the place of Judaism or Christianity or Islam or any of the associated faiths in the world of Scion.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where if we all agreed to not talk about it, that would be fine. But when you're like, hey, this is a thing over here, you're not helping, which raises a lot of other questions. But then again, we're literally talking about an urban fantasy game. If you take any of the premises and run with it, you will never get a world that looks like ours, because that's not how historical contingency works. But such is the way of things. I'm thinking of the Kevin and Kel comic where there's like, there was a rabbit Jesus. It's just like, wait, what? The next section is the introduction where it lays out a couple of things. One, it says what is unique about being a demigod in this version is it is up or out. You'll become a god and your mortal self will die, or you won't become a god and your mortal self will die. Once the journey begins, it is very hard to stop. And by that, there is no mechanical way to have it stop, and it will probably result in the death of your character unless somebody fudges something.
Yeah, there are a couple of places where you can kind of keep yourself in divine limbo, but you're very much making a choice to hold off what's happening at that point, yeah, rather than continuing on the path of being a demigod, which can also be a cool story.
Oh, yeah. And later on, they mentioned the story of Ixion and why they are an interesting character. Once a character acquires the fifth dot of legend, they are officially a demigod, and a whole bunch of demigod things start happening. Later on in the first chapter, it indicates that it actually occurs when you do a particular deed that is not necessarily tied to that fifth dot that kind of recapitulates the godhood story, but such is the way of things.
Yeah, that's one where I think it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg situation, mm-hmm, because the repetition of the divine story is the thing that sets you on the path, but becoming a demigod is what sets you up to have that path in the first place. I think the way I would play that at the table is that as soon as the story has completed, the story is completed that grants a player character their fifth dot of legend when they complete a deed, I would say, okay, the next thing we're going to do is this first milestone, and we'll go from there.
It also mentions that it's going to introduce a number of new pantheons within the game. It makes a specific mention that Mesopotamian authoritarianism is out of touch. Roughly 2/3 of humans on the planet are under some sort of authoritarian regime, unless in the world of Scion, like China is a democracy or something like that. It also calls City of Mist, City of Mists, and has weird templating on page 13, just to make sure, if anyone was worried that I wouldn't be pedantic and nitpicky at certain points, I just wanted to allay that early in our discussion. Chapter one is story guiding apotheosis, and the frontispiece of the chapter is an angel, which we will never get.
I think that might be one of the coolest pieces of art in the book, actually.
Yes. Yeah. More accurately, it is a character with wings. Any number of beliefs have something where a person has wings. It just feels unusually angelic.
I think it is actually the signature character of Donnie.
Okay.
Donnie Rhodes, the Scion of Aphrodite from the first edition, who is one of the signature pantheon, because he has wings in first edition. So I think this is wings and two guns. So you have the black and white guns there, which are part of his panoply of divine birthrights. So I'm pretty sure that's Donnie.
Nice. So not an angel in that case, just a guy with wings, as you do. Welcome to Scion. A demigod who decides to pursue apotheosis, godhood, has some difficult choices to make. She can follow her own path by overcoming a series of archetypal challenges that sharpen her identity to the point that fate cannot deny her divinity. The act of becoming a demigod is a scion's declaration of fate itself that they will become a god or die trying. Also, they will die anyway. That's a thing that's kind of, I feel, soft-pedaled throughout the book, or I misread it.
They certainly shed mortality. I'm not sure if that's the same as dying, but it's a similar shape to dying.
You won't have a living human at the end of it.
Right, because part of the journey is burning away the mortality that is left.
Mantle is now capitalized, which it was not in Hero. The concept of mantle to me is still not entirely explained in enough detail where I feel like I can really get my hands around it. It is a combination of all of the deeds and titles and actions you have done to generate a notion of who you are in the world. I don't know if it's synonymous with divine identity or not, because it is treated in so many different ways that I'm not sure. And also the term persona doesn't appear to be accurate, because a mantle is seemingly much more totalizing than that. What is a mantle to you? Because I feel it's really core to this whole demigod conversation.
The mantle is kind of the underpinnings of a character's divinity that is their mythic representation in the world. At least that's how I understand it. This is the understanding that I have gleaned out of the material, not that is stated directly. Gods may have multiple mantles. So this is where you can have a god who has different stories in different places with different names, but they're clearly the same god. An example off the top of my head may be like Icelandic Woden versus old Anglo-Saxon Woten. The look and symbols and practices and stories are a little bit different, but they're clearly the same god. So that would be one god with two mantles. But you can also have those mantles split among multiple people. So if you are a child of Odin and reenact somehow the Anglo-Saxon versions of those myths to build up that mantle, you may get to the end of your journey and Odin will give you the mantle of Wotan of the Anglo-Saxons, and you are both Odin and Wotan in some ways. I think we're going to get a little bit more about how mantles actually work and what they mean to the gods when we get to God. Because within demigod, you don't have a mantle yet. You are working towards one.
And that mantle economy is kind of fascinating to me. It is one of the things that, since each of these levels is worked towards from another level, it uses frequently the language of the thing you become to describe the thing you are doing. And I really feel at the table, I would want a firmer definition of that so we can have that philosophical conversation of, so what is this actually? I feel that agreeing on that concept helps settle a lot of narrative and system questions, because when you have that kind of, let's say, statement of principles, I feel it makes way easier to say, well, what direction do we want the arrow of the story to point? That is me. I found it frustratingly vague.
Yeah, there's definitely some places where I wish there was a little bit more. And this, we're really getting into chapter one here, which talks about the divine journey. And when we talk about taking on a mantle, there's kind of three paths to that it outlines. And it only gives us details for one of them, because the three paths are forging your own mantle, taking up a mantle from another demigod who has failed, but who has accreted a mantle. And the example they give of that is Maui of Polynesian myth, where Maui died attempting to achieve their final deeds. And so there is no god Maui. Maui's a demigod. But you could follow that path and claim the mantle of Maui and become Maui the god. And then the third way is to go after a mantle belonging to another god. So you're the son of Zeus, working to overthrow Zeus and become Zeus, for example.
It mentions that the way you dismantle a mantle is you can seize it from someone by forcing someone to go against their nature, which is interesting because what a god does is kind of defined by it. And it is seemingly the case that in relatively rapid succession, you need to repeatedly force a god to go against their nature, to strip them of the aspects of their mantle to seize it. And we get no system for that. To me, we would need some inkling of what a god can or cannot do, unless we are saying in a demigod game, we do not use the mechanics for gods, which is fine. I just want you to tell me that. Kind of like, to make a bad comparison, in Old World of Darkness, I recognize that Vampire exists as a game, but in my mage game, I have a mage version of vampires that I use. So likewise, I feel as if we are suggested to use a demigod version of gods and not actual mechanics for gods, which we will get presumably when God comes out, which is a weird sentence to say. And I hope that involves a very fabulous moment of Jesus. Anyway.
So it does talk a little bit about it because it gives you the specific paths to disrupt the pieces of their identity. You can disrupt their callings by orchestrating failure deeds. You can disrupt their purviews through birthrights and faith bindings. So it gives you a little bit, but it doesn't kind of put it together in a way that gives you, here's an antagonist, and these are the things you can do to disrupt these different traits. And so I think that's, it gets like most of the way to talking about that. But then when you do claim a mantle from a god, again, you have three options, and they do go into more detail here. You can usurp that god, that's killing Zeus and taking his title. You can share that the primary god gives you one of their other mantles. You become an aspect of that god. Or you can surrender. You say, I have elevated our legend, and now I become one with it. And I think they're all kind of narratively interesting, but I would have liked the same level of detail in the options of taking up an incomplete mantle or kind of most interestingly foraging your own mantle.
The steps as outlined each come with an additional dot of legend. So the first one is you recapitulate that story that has come before. Whatever your awakening to your Scion heritage is, or your Scion being was, comes back in some form. It may be a similar trial. It may literally be the same entity. I refer to this as new game plus mode for the Scion. This is your capstone as a hero. There is then some act of parting where you discover new burdens. You gain a bond that will be developed until it is very strong and then ultimately cut, kind of symbolically indicating your step away from the mortal world, which is then also done again in a different form in a later step. We have the threshold, which explores your connection to your callings. It is a period of playfulness. You decide what you are the archetype of. This is a stage of learning rather than declaring. You're still not in control of who you are. You have the descent, where you go literally into the underworld, or figuratively, if that is more appropriate, where you shed your associations with the mortal world, which makes it easier for you to step out of the world, capital W. And then the theophany, the myth-defining challenge that if you succeed, you get that final got, and ta-da, godhood. Any additions to kind of that, those steps?
Two things. First, the middle three steps can happen in any order, and they talk about how you kind of tune the tone of the story by readjusting the order of those steps. So you can have the descent at the beginning if you want a very dark story, or you could have the threshold at the beginning where you are cycling through your callings and exploring who you are before you have the parting and the threshold. So you've got multiple ways to approach the middle part of the story. The other thing that they do here is that each of these has not just narrative beats that you are supposed to hit, but some structured rules to them mm-hmm. that impact your character through that whole arc of the demigod journey. And I think it looks like it would work really well to tell that story using all of those pieces. Kind of taking a step back, I think this could be really hard to run for more than like two players.
I have great opportunity for solo play, bold in my notes.
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of ways to do it, because this is one of those things where it's a lot of work for each character, and each character is going to have their own journey. So how do you weave it all together? I think solo play is something that I'd like to explore more of, and I think this would be an excellent game for solo play. The other one would be to take on the challenging job of weaving these things together so that the artifact that one demigod needs is in the hands of the monster that the other one is trying to slay. So you have their divine quests overlapping. The threshold where you cycle through your callings can happen at any time while other stuff is happening. So you could be spotlighting a different character's parting while everyone else is going through their threshold. So there's definitely some ways to weave it together, but I think a typical table is 3 to 5 players. I think that's pretty fair to say that's a typical table for a role-playing game. And I think more than three, and you really, even at three, but more than three, you certainly start to have a hard time balancing all of these different story beats, unless you don't dive kind of deep into them and let the players resolve them a little bit faster while they are helping each other with other pieces of the story.
This could also be one of those things where, like an Invisible Sun, Take a Drink, the two mechanics we have are coincidence. Hey, it turns out that the thing you need for this step in your journey is also in this place that this character needs to go for a similar reason. But that gets really messy to me in multi-pantheon games, where it's like, well, why would you be descending into her underworld? and so on. And also, the fact that so much is going on, this feels really intense on the amount of bookkeeping that could theoretically be required. There are a lot of capitalized terms. You've got a lot going on. But it also gives you the option that says, hey, just have 5 epic stories.
Yep.
Pick one of these. And I really, if I were to run this, I really feel that would be the direction I went. I can really see how the framework laid down would make an absolute banger of a novel, but may not necessarily be feasible for table play. Listeners, please know I say that not having played it, and that is always a precarious position to be in. The steps they outline in the mythic stories, I think, are pretty fascinating. When you dive into some of the details, to me, they are a little bit confusing. For instance, if demigod is about declaring to fate who you are going to be, but there is a step where you constantly shift up your identity, that does not feel tonally consistent to me. I do like the idea of that phase where you go, am I bringer of hearth flames, or am I the flame of justice, or am I the bringer of hearth and home and hearty fare and well-fed friendship? But having that occur at your 7th dot of legend feels like you really have, like, it's like, this is who I am, Dad. The other thing that kind of happens is it specifically mentions once you get that 5th dot, whatever the dink you're the scion of knows you're on the demigod journey, and we get very little information about what that means. Does that mean they just try and kill you because you're coming for one of their titles? You have to have a mantle, and there is no way for a demigod to create one of their own mantles.
There is. There's just no rules support for it. It does specifically say that you can create your own mantle.
Considering everything else that goes along, I consider that one line to be the outlier.
Okay.
Because to me, I can't presume, I don't know what the writers were thinking, requiring a god to generate a mantle, I think, creates an obvious direction of action. Because if there is a path that does not require you to directly oppose a force of divinity, that feels like such a fundamentally different game. Because even at the end of the day, the other methods to get a mantle are changes in flavor. You are still going through the process of freeing the mantle from somebody else, more or less.
You can create a new one.
There is a godlike entity that you need to interface with, and to remove that, to me, defeats the purpose of it.
What about a story where you are battling one of the Titans as your divine journey?
That is the case that eventually you will need the recognition of the god that should have been doing that. Okay. Or you are taking the mantle of the god that is dead that was doing that, or something like that. Again, this is me speculating. It is weird to be like, okay, here's a bunch of things. They all require directly interfacing with divinity, which to me narratively makes way more sense. But there's this weird other path that we're not giving mechanics for, and we're only going to mention once. I think twice. Yeah. On it.
I really do wish they had stronger support for that path.
And all of these work. This is not a criticism that any of these cannot be done. It is just the fact that I do not feel that from page to page, it had a consistent idea of what this process was. One of the things that kept occurring throughout this book is it felt like there was a reference document that I wasn't allowed to look at that explained all of this stuff. And I'm like, the final thing to me that this section had was a notion on what demigod fame looked like. And this was an interesting idea that I feel didn't quite deliver the goods, in the sense that, yes, you are going to be constantly creating complications. There are casual miracles, which we get later, which are awesome and flavorful, and they didn't really come up too much in here. The fame question is really, to me, built into the two steps where you say, I am cutting ties to the mortal world, and I am creating a new tie, which I will eventually destroy, which in the process, I will lose one of my callings. And the fame commentary, I don't feel necessarily matched the power of the mechanics we got later, where to talk about questions of wealth. You are almost beyond mortal wealth at legends like 6, 7, and 8. It, to me, this was good advice to use in the higher levels of hero.
Right, that makes sense.
But yeah, otherwise, it gives some advice to how the world changes around you in terms of informal connections. Later on, we get a lot more information about how the formal changes will occur. Overall, this is giant and fascinating and bold, and it's trying to do something really good, and that's a really hard jump to land. And I think it got pretty close, but you're going to have to bring your own in some cases.
There is some assembly required. It gives you the tools to do it, and it points you in the direction. But like we've said, there's a couple of paths that they say, hey, this is a path. And then they don't give you the directions or tools to do it. You almost need to build your own tools or repurpose the tools here if you're forging your own mantle, or at least throw out what they have for the final step of the theophany. Because if you're making your own mantle, you are not challenging one of the other gods. There may be some divine conflict or something that you have to do, but you're not doing one of those take a mantle from an existing god paths. There just isn't the material for that. But like Terry said, there's a lot here. I think when we talk about making the demigod path unique as a, like, this is the kind of storytelling that it is, this chapter does it. And like, yes, that piece, oh, yeah, of it, like they said, this is our hardest problem, let's solve it. And they absolutely did.
Yeah. And it's also one of those cases where to have your first chapter of your book be a storytelling chapter has some like big story guide energy to it for a book that is notionally player facing. And I'm like, huh? Yeah. As Chess says, they came out swinging. Anything before we talk about the pantheon?
I had one other thought. We were talking about how to do the demigod journey for multiple characters, which I think is going to become one of our other take a drink references, which is troop play.
Oh, interesting. Okay. What is troop play and how would you see it working in Sion?
So troop play is where each player has a main character, but there is a cast of other characters who they may play in support of another main character. So if you have your band of heroes at the hero tier and they complete their hero journeys and they step onto the demigod path, they may split ways and each player may take on a supporting role in another player's story as they go on their divine journey. So you could have the split path with all of the players still involved because they're playing other characters. For example, we have the parting where you build up this relationship through a fate binding with another character. Wouldn't it be great if instead of an NPC, that was another player character in a troop play sense, where through that part of your divine journey, you had one of the other players who had their own demigod as the subject of the fate binding for your parting. You could have someone take on your divine creature or other denizens of the world or any of a number of other supporting roles where they are maybe in the demigod tier as a legendary being who is not a god, or mortal characters that are in support of the story, or other heroes that kind of show, well, what if your path was a little bit different? And so you tell an ensemble story instead of keeping the whole band together.
And I could see that being great, especially because you have the phase where you basically need to fate bind someone up to level 5 and then kill them. I am exaggerating, but you have to build a very strong tie and then dissolve it. I, as the storyteller, would not want to necessarily roleplay that because that would be pretty intense. So if Chaz does that while Sarah's character is doing the journey to the underworld off screen, that seems like a logistical way of dealing with that. You bring up the reasonable point. If we do hit all these points and all of them take two sessions for a band of four people, this is 2 years of role-playing, something like that. So, yeah.
Let's move on to Pan's Theon.
Yes. We get four new pantheons in this. Five. Too many damn gods.
The Anunna are the gods of Mesopotamia. They are described as kind of almost forgotten in the modern world, where they have abandoned their worshippers for their worshippers' imperfection, and so their worshippers have mostly abandoned them, and now they are trying to amend their ways. Is kind of the core story of the Anunna. What did you think of the presentation of these gods?
I think they called them out for something a lot of pantheons did. They talk about how authoritarian and brutal they are, and the fact that they are willing to wipe out all of their own people, which has happened in a number of other pantheons. That there was a pre-human or early human thing that was wiped out except for something and then repopulated. I think their story is a little bit internally inconsistent, where they talk about their people abandoning them and the cause of that. Were they too brutal and people turned their backs on it? Was it other invading things? They talk about colonialism being one of the things, but when I think about like ancient Assyria, colonialism seems to be the wrong thing for when Babylonia or the Hittites invade. If Nineveh is burned down, that I wouldn't call that colonialism. So I don't know if it's making more of an idea that in this world, like Sykes-Picot or something would be the modern point where it was dissolved or something like that. Again, not a religious scholar by any stretch of the imagination, nor do I have a particularly good grasp on geopolitics and world history. They're called brutal, and then it lists a number of the gods, like loves humanity, visits them all the time, will give you back scratches if you're good to them, loves puppies. And then later it settles on the fact that they are distant from humanity just because they think gods are so much further above humans because they view themselves as rulers and nobles. They present them as kind of ridiculous, but for me, it's really hard to interpret very old stories. The very nature of language changes. I am curious what it means for a god to kill humanity. Like, what happens to you if you kill all your own worshipers? Like, that's a choice. I think that's an interesting thought experiment. I like that each god is also, or several of the gods are, is also a number. So like, Ishtar is also the number 12 or something like that. This is what happens when you deal with a
15.
When you use a vigesimal number system? No, it's a hexvigesimal system. What's it, base 60? I think the stories were weird and alien, and I think that was interesting. And at some points it's kind of like, ha ha. But to me, I interpret that as there is a deep, obvious symbolism that we are not getting that people would at the time, kind of like the way people read the book of Revelation now when they're like, what does it possibly mean? But anyone who is familiar with the political goings on when the Revelation of St. John was being written would be like, oh, this is overhand. This is over obvious. kind of like
on the nose there, yeah, John.
Exactly. Like when you read a political cartoon or something like that, and you're like, this is a bit, why is the elephant choking that guy? You're like, oh, I was heinously disappointed by the art because it uses that kind of semi-photographic style and it presents them as statues. Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't love that. There was a bird in there though.
Yeah.
Pelican. He's pretty nice.
What did you think about the Anunna?
I think you summed them up very well. I thought they were very interesting. They are a pantheon that I would love to use in a game at the hero tier, even if no one is playing one of their scions. I think it's I like bringing really ancient stories that aren't going to offend anybody to the table in new and interesting ways. And a pantheon like the Anunna is perfect for that.
I did like the fact that they have three items that they have tied to them. One is the battle bison, which I don't know what else you need. It tells you what it is on the tin. We finally got Lamassu and Shidu. I love them. The meh is a instruction manual for the universe, which is kind of cool. We also get the item, the groove box of Gilgamesh, which can pair with any speaker, Bluetooth or not. If you have a device in your game that offers flawless Bluetooth speaker, I'm sorry, that is above five dots. Like, that is a legend unto itself. I have now made my bad joke about them. The next we have are the pantheon of the Incas. Chaz, who are they?
The Pantheon of Inkus are the Apu. They are presented as, they are trying to reestablish themselves among their worshippers, the people of the Andean Plateau. And they present a bunch of different gods here. Terry, what did you think about the Apu?
I like the fact that there is a great primordial force, Viracocha, who has an intermediary in the form of Inti. And I like that. I like the idea that they do have kind of this wink towards there being a great god, and then there's just this intercessory thing. Because I think a lot of belief systems have a complicated relationship with the celestial hierarchy and who worships what at one point. It is not uncommon that it is that a faith has an idea that, no, we don't worship God. We worship the entities that serve God, because to worship God is too grand to even hear our prayers. There is no degree of supplication that would warrant us bothering that entity. So you have lesser beings that you pray to, and those are the ones that you interact with. And it just kind of shows variety. The descriptors, again, because you had a culture that wasn't directly influenced by Egypt, Greece, or China, you have different associations. You have Chaska, who is not just beauty, but suffocating beauty. Connie Rea, who is fertility and trickery, which is a combination I never want to hear together, but I get it. You have Mama Kila, who is the patron and protector of the menstrual cycle. I don't know what it means to protect the menstrual cycle, but I'm glad someone's looking over it. Pachamama is nature, wild and free. It is a witch attended to by spirits. There is the cosmologically, they have three worlds that periodically run into each other. So I like the idea that their parts of the world sometimes overlap and sometimes don't, as opposed to it being tied to a place. We have the Pishtako, who are weird, tall, and wide-headed people who steal the fat from people, keep the world weird. They do say, no, sacrifice is important. And I also like the contrast. This book is much more comfortable talking about how pantheons relate to each other than some previous books have, which I certainly appreciated. They say they dealt with the loss of empire better than the Teotl, and they generally get along with other pantheons.
One of the other things about the Apu's relationship with the other pantheons is actually with the next one, the Atua, that because of their pre-colonial contact with each other, they were like the only two pantheons who knew each other. And so they are like two roommates who have been living together too long. And I found that somewhat entertaining. So Terry, who are the Atua?
The Atua are the gods of Polynesia, and they are described as the children of the earth and sky who fought to separate their parents so that the light of the world could be let in, and by extension, humans. They very much have stood at odds with each other. There are different versions. For instance, it has a number of asides on this is the Hawaiian version. And this goes back to what Chaz was talking about earlier. At what point is something a mantle? At what point is it a separate god? I would argue that the similarity between some of the gods presented here is closer than a god with two different mantles. And that is fine. I really don't care. And I appreciate there being that space, because I really don't want to get into the argument of, like, how do we divide these two? So that is a rare case of Terry going, I don't care about a basic theological and descriptive question within the game. Rongo represents civilization. Rahua is a plasma ball on the other side of the universe that nonetheless has fond relations with a number of other gods. Tauhiri speaks with the scream of the storm. As Chaz mentioned earlier, Maui is mentioned as an example of a demigod that failed and was just eaten by a fish. Tuma, the god of war and humans, who at one point proposed murdering his parents to be like, you know, do we just gonna get this off the table? Pele, probably the best known, outright violent towards humans. They have a cosmology with a number of heavens that have different roles in different homes. Mauna Kea is presented as being sacred, and in the world of the world, in the world of Sion, the gods at one point said, you need to leave this mountain, we're going to destroy everything on it, after a number of telescopes were built, and then they did. And only the Ali'i are able to step foot on it, which I mean, that's a flex. The balance they try and strike is between the sacred and the curious. And to me, this is one of the more interesting balances that some of the pantheons try and strike. This pantheon as a whole was a little bit alien to me, just because it's a different culture. You're ocean-based. You have a different set of associations with things. Like, they talk about the number of different versions there are of the god of fish, which makes sense if you're an oceanic people. But for me, I'm like, why do you need so many damn fish gods? As a thorough landlubber, I thought it presented a number of interesting questions, and I wish I had a better way to end this sentence. What did you think about the Atua, Chaz?
I thought there were a lot of interesting pieces here. The Atua are another one where I think they offer interesting stories that kind of cross family drama with the divine. I like that they are their own titans as well. When representatives of other pantheons came and was like, well, who represents the tie of the cosmos to humanity and storytelling? And the Atua are like, well, that's us.
Yeah.
And they're also like, who represents the foundational forces of nature? And they're like, well, that's us too.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really talk about them hitting this line between God and Titan. And then with their kind of place in the modern world, they have this really strong tie to trying to restore the balance of humanity and nature, particularly pressing on other pantheons to get their worshippers to do anything about global climate change. And so I thought that was a very interesting take on the pantheon. I am going to gripe for a second here. They depict in the art Tane Mahura, who is the god of forests, birds, and beauty. They say his greatest enemy is rats, which is great. But they depict him with blue and gold macaws, which are a Central American bird, rather than a bird from New Zealand, since these are presented as the Atua of the Maori of Aotearoa, which is New Zealand. They could have picked any one of the lovely New Zealand parrots that would have been far more appropriate, or many of the other highly endangered or recently extinct birds of the Polynesian islands that would have been more appropriate. So this has been Bird Facts with Chaz. The other delightful New Zealand parrot is the kea, who is more adapted to predators because they are a predator themselves. They are a predatory parrot who eats other birds and lizards and stuff, and also fruit and the like. But they're a mountain parrot that like lives in the snow, and like there's a lot going on with the kea that you're like, wait a second, that's not normal parrot behavior. Like I said, this has been Bird Facts with Chaz.
I like to think that those parrots as depicted are part of some sort of cultural exchange, or alternatively, that god is showing that they're a little bit more worldly. If we're going to do a Scion apologetics, I'll jump on that one.
Okay. Next up are the Tengri. Terry, can you tell us about the Tengri?
Who I love more than words. So a little bit of background is they are listed as the warrior protectors of the Altaic people who chose to embrace Buddhism. This is a fascinating example of once you start a religion, you don't get to choose where it goes. So it is fascinating as a Westerner who learned about the character of the enlightened Gautama to be like, when the Buddha created the world. And I'm like, that's not how that happened. I'm not going to argue. The other weird thing is they kind of call it Mongolian, where to me, a lot of these beliefs, I would say, are much more Russian, like South and Eastern Russian, like in terms of steppe culture. It's one of those things where Altaic peoples are kind of underrepresented in ethnography and so on. So it's one of those things where it's like, the most recent scholarship we have on this is a comment a guy made in 1928. This is not great. Ooh.
I suspect the other reason they're tied specifically to the Mongols is that of the Altaic peoples, the Mongols are probably have the best literary sources for anything older than 100 years. Mm-hmm. Because when the Mongols built their empire, they also constructed a written language in order to keep written records.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is more preservation of Mongolian culture that is not modern than many of the other steppe peoples.
This is one of those things where the game has to make choices. You can take kind of Mongolian shamanic practices, Buddhism, and a lot of other things as kind of like a third pole. And anywhere you put the dot, balancing those three elements is probably expressed somewhere in the Altaic region. But it's a game. They kind of have to pick.
Yep.
The choices they went with was kind of this heavily Buddhist inflected interpretation of what in a lot of cases are what would be called in this game, Yazata figures, as well as a little bit of Hinduism, just just a skosh. Also, a fair number of Manichaean influences for those of us who think that Gnosticism has gotten short shrift. The Tengri are listed as a reasonably chill, highly cosmopolitan, very friendly group that has survived syncretization and is kind of in its own way thriving. You have Gadzir, who is commanded to create by the Buddha and is the patron of blacksmiths. You have Hormuzda, who has legion interpretations. And in here, there is no tie with the Usada or Hinduism, which is interesting. You have Genghis Khan, the Khan of Khans, who seems like he should get epic stamina based on what I know of his genetic legacy, but just putting that out there. You have Atanga, who is the storm god, who has lived many short incarnations. Dayusan, who was a god of bloody war, who after contact with the Buddha became a god of forceful peace, which I like. There's a male fertility god. We don't get a lot of those out there. We get Erlik Khan, who is kind of this Venus-like figure and was the demon ruler of Tamu, who spreads disease as a exercise in mastering evil. Can be very helpful, but must be tricked into doing it. I thought these were fascinating. They were friendly. Some of the other pantheons have a very strong, if you get this wrong, you're a bad person. I did not get this from that. Maybe I should, but I loved the cultural blend here. It was super fun. It, I think, serves a great template if you want to play with things. Their cosmology is this fascinating mishmash of everything that is believed within 2,000 miles, which is a lot. There's a lot of humanity in that circle. Just putting that out there. That people have many souls, that spilling blood can allow them to escape and they can be kidnapped. They have a relatively recent hell that they're like, everyone else has a hell. We should probably get a hell. It also suggests that the Palace of Buddhism are a pantheon out there, which is fascinating because we now have one of the five largest faiths on the face of the planet, theoretically in the game. And boy, howdy, did that whet my appetite.
I think the plan is for them to be in God.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think the plan is for them to appear in God.
I am very curious to see what that looks like. But yeah, I thought it was interesting and friendly, and this is something I would use in the game after I consulted a couple of YouTube videos guiding my pronunciation, because this book tries to give you pronunciation guides, and I just need a little bit more than that.
Yep, I liked them. I thought they were interesting. A lot of cool characters. Interesting place in the world, especially, like you said, with their relationships with other pantheons. And talking about the different gods, just like going and meeting gods of similar things in other areas of the world and like just hanging out.
Yeah.
They definitely seemed like they could be fun.
The sense I got was, have you ever met that person that has such a strong sense of self that they can effortlessly change to a new person? It's one of, and it's kind of close to the, what do you do when the thing that you think defines you break and you survive, and maybe you realize that your sense of self is much more robust? It's like that in God form.
Yeah.
It is one of those things that if a god's mantle changes, does the god change to match the mantle or vice versa? And I think it brings up some interesting questions of identity. But yeah, it was just fun. And just the line where they're like, we need a hell. We should get on that. And they're like, what should a hell have? And they looked around and they just kind of stole some things. They're like, this is our hell now. It's like traditions have to be made somehow. And they just decided to be very deliberate with it. They're like, this is what we believe now. And everyone's like, okay. But
it's definitely a cool one. Also, their art includes a bear riding a horse, which I think is delightful. Finally, we get the Bogovi of the Slavs, which is a take on the Slavic pantheons that I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, just doing a little bit of background, I did not realize that roughly 300 million people on the planet are some way categorized as Slav by some definition. Yeah. Again, this is another case where there's dozens of interpretations because you're dealing with a region that, even if they have several related languages, have dozens of alphabets that are not mutually intelligible. So over written history, they will certainly diverge in a way that is kind of interesting. These are gods that very actively oppose each other until threatened by an outside force. And they very much represent the basic concerns of the world around you. The gods themselves are interesting to me because you can have a god that has an interesting dominion, that they oversee something that I would find fascinating, such as the god of intrigue or something like that, or a god that is a weird blend of things. The god of the forge and storytelling kind of gives you an idea of how a culture ties those two things together. Or you can have a pantheon where they just are all shit goblins to one another. And I very much get the sense that the Bogovi are that. They are notionally kind of led by Perun, who is this warlike figure who wields a great copper axe, who would one day like to see a world of peace, but we're not there yet. Morena grants eternal life to those who reach the top of the mountain of Yav, and she oversees the dead, the realization that, life is the short part, and a perpetual state of death on this glorious mountain is kind of the eternity that follows you for living a good life. She is the god of winter, but she herself is warmth. To me, this kind of translates to she is the power to endure. Sverog is the divine smith, the first of the bogs. Dasbog interferes with the affairs of others. He is a god that grows old and ages over the course of the day, carrying the sun. Every day he is surprised to reach old age, which I very much like as kind of a metaphor. There are changes that happen in our life that we all know that are going to happen. We're still surprised by it. The first time in your 30s, you realize that your cortisol injection to the knee years old, or I'm going to need a fistful of ibuprofen to lift this box years old, is one of those things you knew was coming, but it's still a surprise when it happens. You have Radagast, protector of travelers. They all have axes. Which I like, and their axes are, if they have one, are reasonably well described. They have an interesting dividing line between God and Titan, which really, to me, focuses yourself on how you're defining Titan. For instance, Bellabog, the white god, is just the only thing that Chernabog does is so discontent with him. But that is his nature, and he is tied to the calling rather than the purview, so he's not a Titan. We get a multi-realm cosmology. We get a few of the Titans, which in some cases are kind of relatives of the gods. The religion focuses generally on a community worshiping one of these gods, and it focuses on morality and community.
I thought they were really neat. I like the Slavic fairy tale nature to them. Mm-hmm. They seem very much like they are looking at small concerns of like family and community again, rather than big cosmic stuff. And I like that about them. And again, this is one that I'm excited to use, not just the Slavic gods, but all of the weird Slavic fairy tale creatures who now come into the game because the Slavic gods exist. And I wish there were more of them later in the antagonist chapter. But Russian fairy tale critters are just great for bringing into a game of Scion.
And that's the interesting thing to me about Scion. Sometimes I want the archetype. Sometimes I want the story of conflict. Sometimes I want the cosmology. And just kind of increasing the number of entities there are in the world kind of adds more and more of that to, in this case, the world. The downside to me of that is I think we get into interesting spaces where some of these pantheons at this point only have several hundred thousand adherents on the outside. If we were to look at what our world's population is. Again, the world implies that these smaller communities are in the world larger, but it is interesting to me to look at the distance between, say, the Devas and maybe the Manitouo in terms of the raw number of worshippers. As it gets more refined, the gods feel a little bit more parochial and a little bit less godlike. To what extent are you really godlike if there's 250 of you, if they're like effing Pokemon? But then again, the game also says, hey, you don't have to use every pantheon. You get to pick. I would have a hard time narrowing it down because I feel like I would be excluding them, but that is me.
I think when you narrow it down, it's not about excluding pantheons, but deciding which pantheons are relevant in this location, in this story. So if you're telling a story in Boston, say, you probably want to have the Tuatha. You probably want to have the Greek gods and the Norse gods. You probably want to have the Manitou. Do you need the Atua? Do you need the Tengri? Probably not. Those aren't major populations in Boston. But if a player were to say, oh, I want to play a character from this pantheon, even though that could let you say, okay, then I need to bring a small amount of that pantheon into this location to support that. But it doesn't then mean you also have to bring in the Apu, for example.
Any other thoughts on the new pantheons before we go on to the demigod characters that are introduced? My only thought is that it updates the scent of the divine, so you know what all the new gods smell like. That's useful.
Yep.
And we also get a recognition that Titanic callings were added in Titanomachy. And this book in some places gets uneasy with a presumption of what other books you have. It certainly takes advantage of all the books that have been published so far. I'll put it that way. So if you bristle at, it's asking me for something besides hero and origin, well, deal.
Yeah, it does pepper in the Titan callings to the new gods, which I think is nice. I mean, I know they would have done that in the core book if they had that idea in the core book, but they didn't have that idea yet. And the Titan callings and Nax are cool, so I like that. The one other thing about the Bogovi before we move on is that their place in the world felt a little bit unsatisfying to me of them being in a tenuous place because of communism being anti-religion. I don't really see that manifesting in like that does not feel like a truth that makes sense in the world as I understand it, because so many Slavs left areas that became communist. There are major populations of like Russians in the United States because they were escaping communism, and I don't see why they wouldn't have brought their beliefs with them. A lot of resistance against communism came from religion, so I don't know why communism would have destroyed the Bogovi, since it didn't destroy a lot of the other religion in many places. There were definitely fervent believers in their faiths, even under communism. So the way that part of it gets portrayed doesn't quite sit right to me, and so therefore the weak place of the Bogovi, while I think is an interesting story beat, doesn't quite land for me the way I'd like it to. That's my final thought.
The next section we had are demigod characters. We got an opening fiction that follows Brigitte through kind of that fifth dot towards starting the demigod thing. And there's a weird part, the way it's phrased, where it's like, I knew this would happen one day, but I didn't think I would be the first. It also, this is my nitpick, it indicates that she took 3 days to get from Atlanta to somewhere else. There is no place in the United States that's more than 3 days from Atlanta as a road trip. that is not necessarily true, but that was just me being indignant for no reason. I did not understand what they were indicating was the callback within her journey. There seemed to be a two-parter where there was a conflict, and then she talks to another divine being and is like, yep. You started. And she's like, ah, shit. So it kind of feels a little bit, it feels slightly mismatched. This opening fiction should have been the opening fiction, I think, for the book.
Yes, I agree. I thought this and its part two later in the book were a pretty strong fiction. I think we don't see the rhyming pattern of her second call because we don't know her hero's story. But I assume it's that cult group that she is dealing with that she must have dealt with before, Night Doctors. So I imagine that is the second call. And then they kind of gloss over the other pieces, but they definitely have a little bit of them in the second part of her story, which we get to later.
We get an update to characters that had been previously introduced, and it's nice to see them with a shit ton more dots and to see how their characters have changed in certain directions in which these characters could have gone. Bhattacharya as the incarnation of quantum fire. I asked a friend of mine, does this person read to you as a badass Vedic? And her answer was, yes, I want that pantsuit.
It's a nice pantsuit.
Yes, it is a sorry pantsuit. And she's like, more of these should exist. This is from a non-gamer. More importantly, leads us through kind of how the characters refine themselves from the vagueness that we got in Origin and Hero to a little bit more refined. You get to see new titles and so on go into them.
I like the presentation of these characters. I feel like there's a little bit lacking. They talk about how, or they note that these characters are incomplete, but they don't consistently point to where. So it would be very hard to take them off the page and just use them because you do not know what pieces are not completed. So having that be consistent or having some pointers would have been nice. I also think it could have been great here because there is a lot of empty space on these pages. Like the character art pages have half text and then a bunch of white space. It would have been great to have like a half page of this is the suggested apotheosis journey for this character to give you five more examples of, hey, here's these characters. You've seen them in Origin. You've seen them in Hero. We're going to take that and build on it. And based on that, we're going to give you some suggested apotheosis journeys both to use as models or just to like pull out and use and tell the story in the game. I think you could have gotten a lot of mileage out of a very limited word count in this area. So those while I do like the ready-made characters, I think that a little bit more could have made them stronger.
We get information on how it is different to be a demigod. You have a lower target number. Your target number on dice rolls is now 7, unless you use a sidereal charm to reduce it further. You are now tier 3. You can always smell other gods. You have the ability to always hear prayer. Your blood becomes magical. It is deadly to humans and other mammals, so shove it into a fish. It gets harder for you physically to be hit. There are complications literally tied to it. Complications, capital C. You get an extra bruised level, but the sheet shows an extra injured level. The world starts bending to your omen. The birthrights start becoming part of your mantle. Creatures can become fate-bound to you in new ways, and you do not have the ability to turn aside that fate binding. Either something is, if you interact with something positive in your fate binding, it'll further that story. If it is negative, they may turn into a nemesis to you. You can fate bind everything now.
Yes.
In the same way that there was that period of time where everything was being turned into a Disney princess, everything can be fate bound to you. It can be a place, it can be a manatee, it can be a concept. I thought these were pretty great. You can start imbuing your legend in artifacts and objects that become associated with you. We get the new Sanctum birthright. You have the ability to kind of build your own special place. This was a lot of the mechanical oomph required to actually be a demigod. And now that I saw it, the description that we get of what the demigod band does, to me, does not live up to it. To me, the fiction we get is not as epic as what is described here. Once you go through all the system sections, what 4 demigods can do in the world is world-defining to me. Unless they are actively being opposed by other demigods and other bits of divinity, the power difference is remarkably clear between them and merely a high-level hero.
Yeah. And again, that's one of the things that they wanted to do. They wanted to make demigod not just hero plus. Again, the rules do it. Good on them there. Chapter 4 really continues the rules of demigod. How do the rules work? There's a revisitation of scale, how that works, clarifying it a little bit. I know that's something that players have had trouble with based on its presentation originally, and this tries to take what they did in Aberrant and bring it into Scion in terms of having clearer scale categories, having it be more clear how they interact with each other. That's nice to have. It adds the collateral rule. I know we talked about that when we talked about Titanomachy and using that in games with Titans. They now also have it that is a default assumption in Demigod, no longer an optional rule. So your actions will build up and divine power will spill out into the world. That's very cool. They get into fate binding and how that manifests at the demigod tier. One of my complaints in Scion Hero was that fate binding didn't feel like it had any teeth. It was purely optional to engage with, and only if you wanted a legend, point of legend. And the legend economy was such that you often didn't need to recover a point of legend. In demigod, it happens all the time. Casual miracles, marvels, catastrophic success, mortal failure, all of these things generate fate bindings, and it is harder to avoid those fates. If you don't engage with your fate bindings, there's a condition of avoidance that gets triggered that they can come back to bite you. I thought all of that was really neat.
I felt the updates to Boons and Knacks to adjust for Demigod and how the scale changes, I thought they were considerate and reasonable. I thought that was well done. We do get 2 new mechanics introduced, or 2 new narrative things. The idea of the casual miracle. You just change the world around you by being there. And we get a lot of them. It does not skimp on giving examples. We also get the idea of dominion and dominion stunts and divinity dice, which I was a little bit shaky on whether or not they were all interacting with each other. I may just have lost track of how the top level headline worked.
The explainer there got a little bit tangled, but I think the intention is that divinity dice are related to your dominion boons. And so your divinity dice express through your dominion. So when you get catastrophic success and mortal failure on the divinity dice, it gets channeled through the most appropriate dominion boon that you have. So I believe that's the connection between the two.
But you don't have to have dominion boons.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, to me, it was a question of being channeled through kind of a purview that may be tied to it. So Divinity Dice, they accumulate as you do cool stuff, pull on a superpower, you pull momentum, and slowly your dice are replaced with what I will refer to as sparkly dice. And if you roll a success with them, and some of the successes are on the Divinity Dice, you get a catastrophic success, which does... you get more than you bargained for. There is also the opposite, where if you fail and any of the divinity dice show a failure, you get a mortal failure. I like the idea of this. This seems like it complicates the entire journey immensely because it occurs on every die roll. So that time when your character is just rolling three dice, 100% of your pool is divinity dice, which forces the pool to get reset, so you are disproportionately likely to get spectacular successes on the things you're good at and mortal failures on the things that you're bad at, which narratively to me, I'm not sure if that is trying to force your character to really focus on the things you're good at, but it feels like it can create some very weird table situations.
Yeah, that's another one that I'd like to see how it really plays out at the table, because I think you're right that it has some weird implications.
And if the goal is to have you burn through momentum to prevent those failures or something like that, okay. But at the same time, momentum becomes kind of a renewed resource because you're frequently doing it to get scale at the demigod level. I thought they were fascinating mechanics. I don't know if they all work, but they made sense. I very much like the collateral mechanic, which is kind of this extension of the tension pool that slowly builds up as you do more and more divine-y stuff that eventually gets rolled, and the storyteller can take the successes from that pool to change the world around you. It is usually not necessarily an immediate threat. It can be, but it allows you to insert more weird and shows how when the elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. It shows the divine sparks kind of flying off of you as your sword clash and the ways in which they can set fire to the world.
Yeah. I do want to kind of back up and talk about Nax a little bit more. It adds a new tier of Nax, Immortal Nax, which a lot of them add feats of scale that have to manifest through your titles. I do find title a little bit tricky because we haven't gotten a really good exploration of title and example titles, which should have been in Hero. But I do think it's nice that the new tiers of Nax and boons don't supersede the other stuff. Like, the stuff that you have in Hero is still going to be useful. You are kind of beefing it up with the demigod stuff. I like that in some of the callings there are pantheon specific Nax. That's really neat. I would have liked more of those. Not every pantheon gets a pantheon specific Nax, even across all of the purviews, but that's the kind of thing that I think could be expanded in another supplement or the demigod companion. I don't know if they're in there, but getting more pantheon specific Nax, I think would be really neat because they are kind of the expression of that calling from the perspective of a particular pantheon. And I like that. I like kind of the more weight that it puts into your pantheon in expressing a particular cultural background. Again, I'm gonna then give one complaint. There's no demigod tier Nax for the Titan callings, and I'm not sure where they're gonna end up appearing, if anywhere, because they do give those callings to the pantheons in this book, but then you don't get the demigod tier support for them. So I'm just kind of curious how or when we're gonna get those.
Any other thoughts on Chapter 4 before we talk about Chapter 5?
Let's jump into Chapter 5.
Chapter 5 is simply entitled Underworlds, and it gives us the Underworlds. I'm not going to dwell on any of these. I thought a lot of them were evocative and just kind of provided vital information. This is necessary because part of your character's journey to godhood is the descent into the underworld. It brings up the idea that there are psychopomps that escort the dead, but also that there are freelance psychopomps that kind of moonlight to escort atheists to places. We also get the idea of the Veil, which is a generic underworld where you're in a giant neon-lit city with a mishmash of buildings, where you are generally taken care of. The food you need is there. There is enough entertainment. And I thought it was, its blankness was remarkably evocative to me. Like, it talks about how you reach each of the underworlds, and you're like, oh, if you want to reach the underworld of the Tuatha, you need to literally sail there. Or in another case, you need to cross this vast desert. For the Vale, the generic underworld, one of the ones mentioned is, in an abandoned building there that never seems to get torn down for some reason, there is a still working elevator. By inserting the correct key into the control panel and pressing the button that appears, characters arrive in one of the Vale's many high rises after an hour-long harrowing shaky ride. And one, that's some Chronicles of Darkness bullshit if I've ever heard it, and I love it. But it nicely answers that question of what about characters that fall through the cracks or don't quite have it. And it talks about how atheists are accepted, but apostates are not. Where, like, they say the gods can be ignored, but they will not be disrespected.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of interesting. The mechanism of purification of a lot of the hells was very vague in terms of how you dealt with the fact that often hells are a place of refinement of the soul or repentance. And that was kind of vague, and I get that. It talks about how characters could break in, some of the neat things that you can find there, the emotional valences of that. I think in most cases, though, there wasn't enough information there, I feel, for me to run that proper journey to the underworld, especially if there's going to be a band there. But to include all of that information would have made this a vastly larger book. You get enough to kind of lead where the book thinks it should go, and you can do some of your own homework from there. Or maybe this works best for things where you're blue booking it with your story guide, or you're doing it away from the main game session. What did you think of the underworlds?
I don't have a lot to add. I thought the Vale was really cool. I like that the death gods all feel a need to protect the Vale, even though it is unclaimed territory by the divine. I like that it's considered neutral ground by the god. Just, I thought that was one of the coolest invented things in this book. So definitely a big fan of the Vale.
I also like how it did not force commonality onto all of the beliefs. So one of the problems that you run into with Scion is, hey, we need a framework to make this game work. How do we represent that this group doesn't actually believe it? And it talks about how the Naraka are like, we don't think we're dead. We're just underground. And that meets our definition of, like, they put the under in underworld. And I like that because they didn't say, no, you're dead. And they're like, no, we just think this is this other thing that we need to do. And death is the wrong word for it. And I appreciated that appreciation.
Chapter six is antagonists, and it updates antagonists for the demigod tier. It adds new qualities and flares that are specific and powerful at the demigod tier. It gives you your new archetypes with pools adjusted for the tier. So it does say that pools don't go up a ton, but to remember that demigod tier antagonists are all going to be target number 7, and it's functional. They also give a bunch of demigod example antagonists. So you've got a few examples here. I think this chapter misses one thing for me, which is that we don't get the supporting characters for the pantheons presented in this book. In Hero, a lot of the antagonists were, here's a bunch of mythological creatures from the pantheons in the core book. We don't get the similar hero tier expansion of each of the pantheons that showed up in Demigod. But otherwise, it's a solid chapter. Again, I would have liked more word count. After chapter 6, we get into the appendix.
I loved the appendix.
I knew you would.
No gods, no masters. The appendix introduces a group called the Keepers of the World that want to sever the gods from the world, as well as the Titans, as well as the afterlife. They kind of want to turn the world into our world. And it is this band of characters that are not part of the core pantheons, but have kind of become divine. And it talks about the machinations, the problems they have with the current state of the world, which is something we don't get commentary on. We don't get people commenting on the metaphysics of the world too often, how they want to change it, which makes sense because your goal is to become a god and then win and then be written into history for all of eternity and then to stay there. It kind of points out that, like, yeah, this is a schlub's game for a lot of people. This sucks for a lot of people. And it gives them all interesting motives. I think the cross-section of characters that they pick where they're like, oh yeah, Confucius, Imhotep, and Heracles all think this is bullshit. And it covers, I think, nearly every pantheon to give a representative to the Keepers of the World. And it talks about kind of what a bunch of demigod or god level characters could try and do. This is a game without metaplot, which is okay, but one of the things that metaplot gives us is an example of the machinations of what characters in the setting will do and how it turns out for people at various power scales. This gives an example of what this tier of character will attempt to change in the world. And they've got brass-plated cojones in an attempt to do it. And I loved it.
Yep. I love this. I love everything in here. We also get Zalmoxis, the Getodacian blood god who is also the patron of vampires.
Yep.
And kind of wants to usurp the plans of the Keepers of the World to be like, and now everything is mine. Apparently Vlad the Impaler was one of his scions historically. Sion needs more of this. This is awesome. There's also a short list of potential Keepers of the World, gods that have been approached but didn't join the conspiracy. I thought all of that was really interesting. The one thing that I wish this had, if we had like another one page, like would be amazing, would be like three story hooks. What are three things that the Keepers of the World are doing that you can wrap your player characters into? Because while I think there is a lot of that implied here, it'd be great to have just like, and here's three ways you can get into it pre-baked in. But yeah, I thought this was really, really cool.
Yes.
And like I said, I knew you were going to like this part.
It is up there with the Deva rocket program in terms of like, yes, I'm glad this exists. So what did you think overall about the book, Chaz?
Overall, I think that I really like everything that's here. I feel like there are some pieces that are missing, and I feel like it's really doing a couple of different things that aren't fully put together. We get the mechanics and story framework for Demigod. That all feels like it has some cohesion to it. We get a bunch of new pantheons, but we don't get the antagonists and other characters to support them. We get a bunch of antagonists that are kind of at the Demigod tier, but not a lot of guidance for how you'd tie them into your Demigod stories. We get the Keepers of the World, who are, as we said, amazing, but again, it doesn't really tell you how. Most of these characters are gods, so how do you make a demigod story about these god level characters? That's something you mentioned earlier. If demigods are supposed to oppose the gods, how do we present the gods in the demigod game when we don't have god traits yet? And so maybe that feels like it's missing from the antagonist section. So everything's here is good. There's just some connective tissue that feels like it's missing.
Missing integument to put it together. It also, as you mentioned, the way I had it in my notes is, it feels like I'm assembling a very large, very beautiful jigsaw puzzle, and I have some extra pieces, but seem to be missing some others. It is very close to the complete mosaic. It seems like there's a lot of bookkeeping that can be involved. The sheer profusion of things that can be in a game, this feels like a maximal version of a toolbox approach almost. And for me, that would be a bit too much to keep track of. But then again, you don't have to use that at your table game. This may sound like a weird criticism, but this book really assumes that you've been running Hero for a while and you've internalized everything. I would have liked a few reminders here and there, like just at the top of the section.
Here's the two-page refresher, or the sidebar at the top of the chapter. These are the concepts from Hero that you need to know, and the one-sentence definition, and the page reference if you want to go get more. That would have been very helpful.
And in some cases, it really felt like this was the RPG equivalent of going through a bunch of TV tropes articles, which is not necessarily a criticism, because a lot of the sections are thorough. Again, going back to the casual miracles, bam, every purview is covered. You get six examples of it. And you're like, oh yeah, I could see how they may have just gone through like a TV Tropes article for something like this. It seems like there's a lot of bookkeeping, a lot of things you can potentially deal with. But I think it delivers on what it would be like to have a demigod. I don't know how you do that in the game. I would love to see a streamlined version of this. The other thing is, this is the version of Sion I want to run. I want characters to start. I want the hero portion to be very short. And then I want Demigod to be most of what the game is. That is personal feel. That is not a criticism of the book. That is the game I want. I didn't realize until reading Demigod, that is what I wanted Sion to partially be. How do you do the epic and personal? I think Demigod answers that question. That's a really hard thing to land. My final criticism is that it uses the phrase warp and weave, which is redundant. Warp is a type of weave. No, your textiles.
This has been Pedantry with, yes, with Terry Robinson.
Yes. The gods feel smaller, but boy, howdy, is there a lot in here. This book is going to inform how I run Mage.
Wow.
The way it recommends to create massive arcs, the way it says, hey, these are the beats that you want to plan out, the way it gives systems to give things that are very powerful, it feels somehow both granular and wide ranging, which is hard to do. I like the Goliath system, which is a way of displaying massive opponents, which is taken from Aberrant, I believe. Take a drink. Actually, no, this is an anti-drink because I actually read it. I think all the systems that are added to make the world feel more like what you want to do are kind of spot on. I think it just is going to be very hard for a story guide. If you're running a demigod game, by all means, tell us. Tell us how you cope with it. I'm very interested. I know there's an amazing game in here. It would just take me a lot of work to get to it.
Yeah, I'm very curious. This is one that I really like what's here. And I'd really like to bring it to the table. I don't know when I'm going to have that time, but it is a game that could provide a lot of really good story for you. And then even if you're not playing at the demigod tier, you've got 5 new pantheons with most of the stuff that you need to bring them to the rest of your Scion game. You've got really interesting storytelling beats. You've got the Keepers of the World, who are very cool. So overall, like I said, I think this is a great book, despite the complaints that I had on my way through.
Yeah, and I'm very curious to see, with each new book, we get a bunch of things that need to be retroactively added. I'm curious to see what happens when we get demigod information for the mythos and stuff like that. Like, what even? Like, I must become Azathoth? Yes, tell me more.
How are you going to claim Azathoth's mantle?
Yeah. The mask, the mantle of Nyarlathotep. So unless you have anything else, this has been Pain in the Dice. Game strong.